quantum state was being treated as part of the description of reality, or whether it's being treated as just a description of what some agent knows about reality. And so this lecture is going to be about the latter sort of hidden variable model. So we're in the context of hidden variable models, and we're considering psi epistemic hidden variable models. And as I said last time, there aren't any full-blown interpretations of quantum mechanics on the table that are of this sort. But today I'm going to tell you just a bit about why this kind of approach is compelling, even though we don't have an example of it yet. I'm going to tell you about how things look on this way of trying to interpret quantum mechanics. So think of it as a description of a research program. So the main, I could say a lot about what sort of evidence supports this sort of approach, but the way I'm going to do it is the following. I'm going to show you that if you start with a classical statistical theory, all right, so you're going to have a classical reality and then knowledge about that reality, and then you add a restriction on the kinds of probability distributions that can be prepared. So this is like Plato's cave. Imagine that for some reason you can't know everything about the underlying reality. And so I'm going to show you a couple of theories that implement as a sort of foundational principle, just to start with as an axiom, suppose that you can't know everything. What follows? And what I'm going to show you is that you can actually derive the experimental predictions of a subset of quantum theory, so not all of quantum theory, but a large part of quantum theory, including a lot of the phenomena that typically people point to as being somehow non-classical and mysterious. So in that approach, what's going to come out is that non-orthogonal quantum states are going to be represented by probability distributions that overlap. So that's the kind of evidence that I'm going to tell you about. There's various ways of doing this. So you could start with different kinds of classical theories. So suppose you start with mechanics. So this is the theory of particles that have position and momenta. The statistical theory for that classical theory is sometimes called Liouville mechanics. So this is the theory that describes how your probability distribution over a classical phase space ought to evolve if the system evolves according to some Hamiltonian. It tells you how your probability distribution ought to update if you do measurements and so forth. Okay, so this is the kind of theory that you would study in courses on statistical mechanics. And then what you do is you implement a restriction on how much you can know, and you get another theory, which you could call restricted Liouville mechanics. I'm going to show you a little bit about how that's equivalent to part of quantum mechanics, which is sometimes called Gaussian quantum mechanics. And the way it's the mapping is going to be made is through the Wigner representation of quantum theory. So you probably saw a little bit of that at the end of last tutorial, and maybe you'll be seeing a little bit more of it at the beginning of next tutorial. But I'll be talking about the Wigner representation. The other kinds of theories involve starting at a different place. So this is a bit of an unusual theory. You start with a classical theory of bits. So bits is what computer scientists call two-level systems. So these are just classical systems that can either be in state 0 or state 1. That's it. And as physicists, we don't usually talk about those kinds of classical systems, but we could describe them mathematically. We could even think about dynamics as a computation, right? So we have two bits, and then a gate between those two bits is like an evolution which causes them to interact. And then we could have a third bit which interacts with the second, and so on. So just as we could have particles interacting, we can have bits interacting in a kind of circuit. And then we can ask about the statistical theory of those guys. So if we have a probability distribution over all the possible bit strings that could be in our circuit, then we could ask, how does our knowledge, that probability distribution, evolve under the gates? How does it change if you do some measurements on one of the bits, for example, and so on? And then, again, you can add a restriction on how much you know and get a theory out. And this isn't so important for what I'm saying, but there's something in quantum information theory called the stabilizer theory for qubits. And that's basically, again, a sub-theory. It's not all of quantum mechanics. It's the set of states which are eigenstates of Pauli operators. So for one qubit, it's just the Z, X, and Y spin eigenstates. Those are the only ones that are included in that theory. And for two qubits, it includes some entangled states. And so it's basically like a discrete analog of Gaussian quantum mechanics. And what you find here is that this theory and this theory are not quite the same, which is why I have this approximately equal here. But they're extremely similar. They have a lot of the same qualitative phenomena. And those are the two theories I'm basically going to talk about in this lecture. There are other examples of this. You can start with three-level systems, derive a restricted statistical theory of three-level systems, and find that that's equivalent to some part of quantum mechanics. Or you could do it for optics, and again, you get something that's equivalent to part of quantum optics. But I'm going to focus on these two. And the reason is that there's certain things that are easier to see here, and certain things that are easier to see here. So I'm going to do a bit of both. And you'll see how it all works, hopefully. So let me start with mechanics. So Liouville mechanics, as I said, is just the theory of probability distributions over phase space. And now I want to add a restriction on how much observers can know about the point in phase space. So I need to come up with a good way of implementing that restriction. And so I let quantum mechanics be the guide here. So remember, there's an uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics. So here, delta squared x is just the variance in x. Cxp is what's called the cross correlation between x and p. So it's the expectation value of xp plus px minus the product of the expectation values. It tells you something about how position and momentum are correlated. And all these expectations are calculated with respect to some density operator. So you can think of this as a constraint on how predictable position and momentum measurements could possibly be simultaneously. So now what I want to do is implement my restriction in a sort of following this philosophy. So what I'm going to do is say, now we have some distribution over x and p, mu xp. That characterizes the agent's knowledge of x and p. Relative to that distribution, I can calculate expectation values of different functions over x and p. So if I have a distribution like this one, I can calculate a variance in position just by using these sorts of expectation values. It's just the width in position of this distribution. And I can calculate a variance in momentum, and I can calculate a cross-correlation position momentum. And then I could just impose by fiat as a sort of starting axiom that you're only allowed to know the position momentum in ways that correspond to distributions. So the distribution characterizes your knowledge. The distribution has to satisfy this inequality. So you can't know, for example, both the position and the momentum of the particle because such a probability distribution would violate this constraint. So again, it's a bit like Plato's cave where the prisoners can only see sort of one aspect of the shape. You know, here, you could know the position, you could know the momentum, you can't know both. Okay, is that clear? Let's see. Okay, so this is just restating it. Actually, I've added one extra ingredient. So the epistemic restriction, the restriction on how much you know, could be called a classical uncertainty principle. And it says that the only phase-based distributions that can be prepared are those that satisfy this inequality and that have maximal entropy for a given set of moments here. So this maximal entropy bit is a way of saying that you know as little as possible consistent with that inequality. So in probability theory, people often use maximum entropy as a way of finding sort of minimally informative probability distributions. And we need it here because it gets us closer to quantum mechanics. It's sort of justified a posteriori. It's, we know what our target is. We want to get something that looks like quantum mechanics. It means, for example, that a probability distribution that's like a top hat in phase space could very well satisfy this inequality, but it's not a maximum entropy distribution. To get a maximum entropy distribution, you need to use Gaussian. Okay, so the top hat is not an allowed way of knowing about the system according to this theory, but Gaussian distributions that satisfy this inequality are valid ways of knowing about the system. So all I've done is describe to you the sort of starting postulate that defines this theory. If you ask, what kinds of Gaussian distributions can characterize an agent's knowledge, well, delta x, delta p could be precisely h bar over 2, if I like. But I can also do some squeezing, right? So I can make the variance in X narrower by making the variance in P wider. And similarly, I can make the variance in P narrower by making the variance in X wider. And I can also rotate in the phase space. So I could have some other variable like X minus P, which has a small variance, and X plus P has a large variance. So the cross-correlation between X and P would be non-zero in this case. And as long as this area here in phase space is not smaller than of order h bar, all of this satisfies that inequality. So this is the kind of thing that, if you made it to the end of the tutorial, second tutorial question, these are the kinds of things you'd be plotting in Mathematica. They happen to be the Wigner representations of certain quantum states. And we'll get to that. In the limit that you squeeze an infinite amount, what you get is something which is arbitrarily narrow in position and arbitrarily spread out in momentum. So this is going to be the analog of a position eigenstate. It corresponds to an observer knowing everything about position and nothing about momentum. Here you've squeezed in momentum, so now you have an arbitrarily small variance in momentum and an arbitrarily large variance in position. And that's what's going to correspond to a momentum eigenstate in this approach. And similarly, you could have something which is an eigenstate of some linear combination of the position and momentum operators, like cos theta x plus sine theta p. And that just corresponds to knowing the associated classical variable and knowing nothing about its canonically conjugate partner. So these are all valid probability distributions according to my starting postulate. And now let me remind you about the Wigner representation, in particular if you were in the tutorial, you haven't seen this. And then I'll make the connection with quantum mechanics. So you can define what's called a phase point operator. So you get an operator for every position in the phase space. And it has this complicated definition here. It turns out there are more elegant ways of expressing it. But we would need more background material to talk about it. So it turns out to be the symplectic Fourier transform of the unitary operator, which displaces you in phase space. But anyways, that's not so important. What is important is that if you consider the set of operators for all values of x and p, that is a basis of the operator space. So it means that I can write any operator, any Hermitian operator, as a linear combination of those phase point operators. And if you recall that the Hermitian operators themselves form a vector space, and the inner product was just trace of A, B, this is the inner product between A and B on that vector space, then if I find a set of operators that are a basis for that vector space, I can just represent some other operator by the components relative to that basis. So you can think of this expression here as just the trace of O with every one of these guys. So these are the components of the operator O in the basis of these guys. And it's a bunch of numbers. Okay, so these are all scalars. That's the Wigner representation. So any operator O can be represented in terms of these guys. This has all the same information that O does. I've just written it in some particular basis. Okay, these are some facts that you may have seen in the tutorial question. If O is a Hermitian operator, then these scalars are all real. Okay, I'm not going to work it out here, it's part of the tutorial, but if you use the definition of the phase point operator, you can prove that when this is Hermitian, these guys are real. So now we know it's a real function over the phase space. Furthermore, if you have an operator like a density operator, which has trace 1, then you can prove that when you integrate over the phase space of this function, you get 1. So it has that in common with probability distribution over phase space. It integrates to 1. What you also find is that if you have a set of positive operators that sum to identity, like a POVM, then you find that when you sum the corresponding Wigner representations of those operators over k, and you multiply by 2 pi over h bar, you get 1. So this, if I take 2 pi h bar times this guy, that satisfies one of the properties of a set of indicator functions. Remember, the indicator functions are the conditional probability of getting outcome k given that the ontic state was lambda. So in this case, the ontic states, the complete descriptions of reality, are points in phase space, x and p. And this function here satisfies the definition that if I sum all of them up for any value of x and p, I get 1. So had these been positive, I could have said, I just should just think of this as the probability of getting outcome k given x and p. And then for every x and p, I'll get some probability, some outcome k, because all those probabilities sum to 1. Good. So finally, what you can prove is that if you multiply the Wigner representation for a density operator with the Wigner representation for an element of a POVM, times this 2 pi over h bar, and integrate over the phase space, you reproduce exactly the inner product, or the trace rho ek, the Born rule. So again, all this says that had these things been positive, I could have represented these as probability distributions over the phase space, these guys here as indicator functions, and this would just be the expression that we've seen before for the probability of getting outcome k given a preparation of rho. Yes?
Do we have to sum over k?
So here I'm just expressing the probability for a particular outcome k. If I sum both sides of this equation over k, here I get identity, trace of rho is 1. Here I'll get sum over k, and I'll just get 1. I'll integrate this, and I'll get 1, so it still holds. So the Wigner representation could have provided us with a nice hidden variable model of quantum mechanics had it only been positive for all quantum states everywhere in the phase space. All I've told you so far is that it's real. So it could still be negative. And if it's negative, you can't really interpret it as a probability. Finally, I haven't said anything about transformations. But it turns out the Wigner representation allows you to talk about transformations as well. It's a bit more complicated. So if I have some completely positive trace-preserving linear map E, right, so that's the most general kind of dynamics in quantum theory. Talked about that last week. Well, it turns out it gets represented by a function which is almost a conditional probability. So a conditional probability would have said, for a given value of x and p, what's the probability of ending up at x prime p prime? Right. So you could have thought of this as a stochastic matrix. Unfortunately, it can go negative. So I can't think of it that way. But it has similar properties. In particular, if I want to know what's the Wigner representation of the evolved version of rho, so E of rho, what I do is I take the Wigner function for rho, I multiply by this quasi-conditional probability, and I integrate over x prime and p prime. Had these things been probabilities, that would be exactly the prescription for how I should take an initial distribution to a final distribution under a stochastic matrix. And the definition of this guy is just you have to use the phase point operators twice. So act the map on the first phase point operator, take the trace with the second one. Okay, so this is sort of like all the ingredients I described about what you need in a hidden variable model, representations of preparations, measurements, and transformations, except they're not necessarily probabilities because they're not necessarily positive functions. Nonetheless, if you look at these distributions here, it turns out they all correspond to Wigner representations of what are called squeeze states in quantum mechanics. So these are a set of pure states which saturate the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and some of them have, well, there's a trade-off between how much variance in X and how much variance in P you have for these kinds of states. For those states, at least, you can think of the Wigner representation in a hidden variable kind of way, that, you know, really there's some position and momentum that the system has, and by knowing the quantum state, you just know what the distribution over position might be. Yes?
Question. If you say these are the statistical interpretations or versions of the momentum or position of eigen states,
yes.
In normal quantum mechanics, these belong to the Riggs-Hilbert space,
yes.
Which does not.
Right.
Yeah, which
so,
is
yeah,
not
so
the physical Hilbert space. Is that exactly the same? I mean, we need distribution theory to express also this statistics. I guess we have something delta
yes.
distribution.
That's right. You have a delta distribution along one axis and a uniform distribution along the other. If you want to do things more rigorously, in quantum mechanics, what you can do is, rather than talking about position, momentum, eigenstates, you can take these squeeze states, which are gassing states, and just talk about the sequence of states and the limit of infinite squeezing. And so at every point along that sequence, you have a valid state. So you can talk about states that are arbitrarily narrow in position, variance in position, and arbitrarily wide variance in momentum. And they'll have, for all practical purposes, the same properties as a position eigenstate. So if you want to be rigorous, you can stay within the Hilbert space just by talking about states that are highly squeezed. And similarly here, I can talk about distributions that are arbitrarily narrow and arbitrarily spread out. And I don't have to go to the limit if I don't want to. But just as in quantum mechanics, it's sort of it's convenient to talk about position and momentum eigenstates. And if you're careful, you don't run into any problems. I'm going to do the same sort of thing here. I'm going to actually be talking a bit about states wherein one of these variables is precisely known and the other variable is completely unknown. Other questions? So the picture is this. This is a little Venn diagram here. It represents a few different things. So this circle here are all the epistemic states. So these are all the probability distributions on phase space. So this is what an agent could possibly know about a classical system. And the theory I've been describing sort of picks out a set of those states of knowledge as being valid, that observers can really have that kind of knowledge, and others as being invalid, observers can't have that kind of knowledge. And over here, this circle here, are all the pure quantum states. And so they're the ones I can, if I want, represent them by Wigner distributions on phase space. And I have lots of different Wigner distributions that are valid. But what I find is that some of those Wigner distributions are everywhere positive. And if we're talking about pure quantum states, those are precisely these what are sometimes called Gaussian quantum states. I just refer to them as squeezed quantum states. So some subset of the quantum states are here in this region. And the rest of them could be called the non-Gaussian quantum states, which have Wigner functions that somewhere go negative. Okay? And so what's interesting is that when you start with the classical theory and you restrict what you can know, you end up getting this part of quantum theory. So the two theories coincide in this region. You don't get all of quantum theory because you don't have these ones, but you get part of it. And the way you interpret that part of quantum theory according to this picture is very interesting. That's what we're going to be talking about. So far I've told you what are the valid ways of knowing about this system. You could also ask what sorts of transformations could you do in this system and still not violate the starting postulate. So you want to make sure that no transformation takes you from having a valid state of knowledge to having an invalid state of knowledge. Well, it turns out that it's precisely the canonical transformations on the phase space corresponding to at most quadratic Hamiltonians, Hamiltonians that are at most quadratic in the position of momentum. So why is that? Well, canonical transformations or Hamiltonian transformations are the only ones that preserve that uncertainty principle I wrote down. I'm not going to prove that to you, but in quantum mechanics, it's sort of we preserve the uncertainty principle because we have all unitaries are generated by a Hamiltonian. In a classical theory, it turns out that if you imagine a dynamics that's not a Hamiltonian dynamics, so it's not allowed by classical mechanics, then you can violate that uncertainty principle. But that would be sort of an ugly theory anyhow. It's nice to start with a theory that really has Hamiltonian mechanics because those are the ones that have had any kind of empirical success so far. So you can prove that the uncertainty principle is preserved by these kinds of transformations. But if you want to keep that Gaussian profile, then you can't use Hamiltonians that are more than quadratic in position and momentum. And so among the valid transformations are things like phase-space displacements. So you can shift the position of your system. You can boost its momentum. You can also do rotations in phase space. And then you can also do squeezing operations where you narrow down the position at the expense of momentum. Those are all allowed transformations in this Liouville mechanics with the restriction on how much you can know. And what you find is that they're associated with quantum transformations. So these transformations I've described here are precisely the Wigner representations of a certain set of unitaries in quantum mechanics, namely the unitaries associated with the Hamiltonians I'm describing here, the quadratic ones. So take this unitary, for example. This is a unitary that translates by an amount x naught. So p hat is the generator of translations in quantum mechanics. So it translates by x naught, and it boosts by p naught. And if you act that unitary on a state rho to get rho prime, and then ask what's the Wigner representation of rho prime, you'll find it's exactly the Wigner representation of rho, but shifted in position by x naught and shifted in momentum by p naught. Okay, so in other words, I can represent this dynamics in the Wigner representation just by a phase-based displacement like this one. Yes?
Why are we willing to preserve Gaussianity?
Because in the definition of the theory, there were sort of two components. One was you have to satisfy your second order moments have to satisfy this, but you also have to have maximal entropy for a given set of those moments. And I haven't given you the proof, but the only distributions that maximize the entropy are Gaussian distributions. So if you went from a Gaussian distribution to a non-Gaussian distribution, you would go from something that satisfies this constraint to something that fails this constraint.
So why do we wish to have this constraint?
Why do we have this constraint? To some extent, it's justified by our target. So if you say, you might have asked, you know, is it possible to get any part of quantum mechanics starting with the classical theory and imposing a constraint on how much you know? Well, I'm able to get Gaussian quantum mechanics, and it just so happens that this is the way I do it. If I drop this bit, what I'll get in, so let me show you the Venn diagram again, if I dropped that bit, I would get some extra distributions over phase space, like top hat potentials in the phase space, which have the correct variances, but those states would not correspond to Wigner functions. So they wouldn't correspond to any quantum state. Okay, so again, these kinds of transformations that are allowed in this theory map on precisely to a set of quantum transformations. And similarly, if you ask, again, what are the measurements you can do in this theory? So the philosophy is the same. Don't allow any measurements which would be such that if you started with a valid state of knowledge, you would end up with an invalid state of knowledge. So for example, if you allowed a measurement of position and momentum simultaneously, then if you started out not knowing precisely what the position and momentum were, and you did that measurement, at the end of the day, you wouldn't know precisely the position and the momentum. So clearly that kind of measurement must be disallowed. And what's left over are things like measurements of just the position. So here I'm drawing the indicator functions in a schematic way, or measurements of just the momentum. Or there are even measurements that are kind of fuzzy measurements of position and momentum simultaneously. So every outcome tells you that the position is, you know, near this point and the momentum is near this point. These guys can also be made to sum to the uniform distribution. And again, you find that all of these guys that you can do in the theory correspond to the Wigner representation of the associated quantum measurements. So this is the Wigner representation of a measurement of the position eigenstates. This is the Wigner representation of a measurement of the momentum eigenstates. So not only do the states that we're getting in this theory map on to some subset of quantum states, but the transformations and the measurements map on to a subset of the quantum transformations and the quantum measurements. And then finally, you can extend this to multiple systems if you like. So I've just been talking about one system. The elegant way to do that is to use a generalization of the uncertainty principle for multiple systems. But that would kind of take me far afield and take a long time to explain. So I'm going to try to take a shortcut. Hopefully this will work. Another way of thinking about it is this. First, just allow products of valid epistemic states. So if you say, here's a valid way of knowing about system one, here's a valid way of knowing about system two, well then certainly, you know, my probability distribution for the pair could just be the product of those two probability distributions. That should be allowed. And then allow any canonical transformation with Hamiltonians that are quadratic in the variables for these two systems. right? So that's sort of consistent with what we've seen so far. It'll keep us within Gaussian distributions. And if you do that, then you're allowed, for example, this kind of transformation, where so A and B are my labels for system 1 and system 2. Here are the coordinates for system A. Here are the coordinates for system B. There exists a Hamiltonian that's at most quadratic in these variables, such that xA transforms to xA minus xB, pA transforms to pA minus pB, and these guys transform to xA plus xB and pA plus pB. This is a valid Hamiltonian transformation, so you may remember something like this from a course on classical mechanics. So the idea is that if we allow a product of valid epistemic states, then we should also allow the probability distribution that arises when you do this transformation. So suppose, for example, that you know the first system, system A, to be in a position eigenstate, or really here I'm talking about this classical theory, I'm not talking about quantum mechanics. So it's in a state of knowledge or probability distribution wherein the position is completely known. So that looks like this, right? So this is system A is in one of these distributions where position is completely known, momentum is completely unknown. And system B is in a probability distribution where momentum is completely known and position is completely unknown. I could write that in terms of this guy. So the overall distribution is just the product of these guys. So that's valid. We should allow that. But now we should also allow the distribution I get by taking this distribution and doing this transformation on the underlying phase space.
Well,
and yes?
You have written both that function as position.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, this should be a PB here. Yeah, that's a typo. If I do the transformation, then at the end of the day, I started out knowing XA and knowing PB. After the transformation's over, you know XA minus XB, and you know PA plus PB. And in this example, you knew XA to be A, so now you know XA minus XB to have the value A. So that corresponds to this kind of delta function here. XA minus XB takes the value A. And now you know that PA plus PB takes the value little b. So that's this delta function here. So this distribution should also be allowed. And it corresponds to knowing something about the correlations between the two systems, right? You know everything about the distance between the two systems, xA minus xB, and you know everything about the sum of their momenta. But you know nothing about the difference of their momenta and the sum of their positions. And I mean, it's hard to draw this in a four-dimensional space, but this function here, as a function of xA plus xB and PA minus PB, is totally uniform, right? So there's two variables you don't know, two variables you do know, just as over here, there were two variables you knew and two variables you didn't know. This is the way of representing within this approach the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen state. So in the original paper by EPR, they talked about particles, and they had an entangled state wherein the positions of the two particles were perfectly correlated, and their momenta were perfectly anticorrelated. And that's this guy here is the Wigner representation of that, and it arises in this theory I'm describing. So in this sort of approach, entanglement is just correlation between the hidden variables of the two systems. Okay. So how can we characterize in general the sets of variables that can be jointly known? So in both those examples, we saw that the observer only had knowledge of half of the variables that were used to describe the system. So what sorts of halves of the variables can you know? It turns out there's an elegant answer, is that they have to commute relative to the classical Poisson bracket. So let me remind you what the Poisson bracket is. So if I have a system with a configuration space R, so that's just the position. Phase space is R squared, specified by X and P. Then I can define functionals on that phase space. So they're just maps from the phase space to the reals. For example, there's a functional that tells you what the position of that point in phase space is. So M here describes a point in phase space. So capital X is the variable associated with position. Little x is the particular position of that point in phase space. Capital P would be the variable momentum. So the Poisson bracket is just this. It's if I take two functionals over the phase space, f and g, Then it's df dx dg dp minus df dp dg dx. Maybe some of you have seen this before. Maybe all of you have seen this before. A show of hands, who's seen Poisson bracket in a previous course? Okay, good. Excellent. So, good. So that's the definition. Now let's remind ourselves of how this works. If I look at pairs of variables like the position of a system and the momentum of a system, I calculate their Poisson bracket, I get one. That's what we refer to as canonically conjugate variables. So in this theory I'm describing, these are the kinds of variables you can't know simultaneously. So you can't know the position and momentum of the same system simultaneously, because they don't commute relative to Poisson bracket. Similarly, the position and momentum of the second system. Or x1 plus x2 and p1 plus p2, they also are canonically conjugate. You can't know them simultaneously. But if you take things like the position of the first particle and the position of the second, and you plug them into that formula for the Poisson bracket, you'll find they do commute, and therefore you can know them simultaneously. Or the position of the first and the momentum of the second. Or the difference in the positions and the sum of the momenta. That is exactly the example we just saw with the EPR state back here. It was the difference in the positions and the sum of the momenta that were jointly known. So what you can show is that in this model, any time a set of variables commutes relative to that Poisson bracket, you can know them jointly. And because canonical transformations preserve the Poisson bracket, or I guess this is just an explanation, that we started out assuming that you could say, you know the position of the first and the position of the second and the position of the third, because you know it was valid to know just the position of the first and so on. So we allowed for the product distribution. Canonical transformations we also allowed with quadratic Hamiltonians that couple the systems together. Those transformations, by definition, preserve the Poisson bracket. So whatever variables you map to, so like in my example back here, where I mapped these guys to these guys, if the Poisson bracket between xA and xB is zero, then because canonical transformations preserve the Poisson bracket between xA minus xB and xA plus xB must be zero. And so that's why the state of knowledge here, where I knew xA and pb simultaneously, maps on to another state of a pair of variables that commute relative to the Poisson bracket. Because it's a canonical transformation, and those transformations preserve the Poisson bracket. Okay, so this is sort of the various part of the lecture. You can define a Wigner representation for more than one system just by using the product of the phase point operators for those two systems. And what you find is that all those states I've just described for you on the joint phase space are valid Wigner representations for certain quantum states. And so the bottom line is that if you define this part of quantum mechanics, which are the states that have Gaussian Wigner representations, these are the squeeze states, measurements that have Gaussian Wigner representations, transformation that preserve the Gaussianity of these states, then you find that this theory I've just defined, Liouville mechanics with an epistemic restriction, makes exactly the same predictions as Gaussian quantum mechanics. And the probability distributions are phase space here map onto the Wigner representations here. So it means that it gives us a way of understanding what's going on, at least in that part of quantum mechanics. And let me give you a couple examples of that. So say I have my pair of systems, A and B, possibly very far away in space. And I've prepared them in one of these states of knowledge where the relative position is known and the sum of the momenta are known. So that's this distribution here. And assume they're known both to be zero. So if you say, what do you know about system B to start with? Right? Just take the marginal on B, you'll find that it's completely uniform over the whole phase space. In this kind of thing, you know nothing about QB and you know nothing about PB. All your knowledge is in the relations between the systems. So you start out knowing nothing about this guy. But if you come along and you do a measurement on system A, say you measure the position, so here I've switched from X to Q, so I apologize, there's an inconsistency in my notation, I didn't have time to change this. So for the next few slides, Qs are just positions. If you measure the position of this guy and find some particular value, then because you knew that the distance between these two guys was zero, then you can update your knowledge about the distance system. So they had exactly the same position. You've just learned the position of this guy, so you can infer the position of the faraway guy. So you update your knowledge to one where you know the position completely and you know nothing about the momentum. If, on the other hand, you measured the momentum of system A, then you would update your knowledge of the second guy as well, because your original state of knowledge is that their momenta are perfectly anticorrelated. One is the negative of the other. So you update this to being at minus p for whatever p you found. So this is similar to the EPR scenario, right? So you saw in some of your homeworks or tutorials this scenario where you do a measurement on one half of an entangled state and you update the quantum state of the other guy. So, yes?
This is not, I mean, in this case, those two particles are going, I mean, the same, but in EPR, one was going the same.
No, it is the same because in this case, PB plus PA is equal to zero, which means PB is equal to minus PA, which means their velocities are in opposite directions.
But QB minus QA is zero, so the position of the model.
That's right. So really, it's a scenario wherein they're, you know, they have exactly the same position along this axis. So when I said these things are separated in space, that's not right. I mean, if we were talking about spins and the EPR experiment with spins, we could talk about them being separated in space. But the original EPR experiment, you're imagining two particles that have been prepared such that you don't know where they are, but the distance between them is zero, and you don't know what their individual momenta are, but you know that one has the opposite momentum to the other. So Einstein was basically saying, look, when you do a measurement on this system and you change the wave function for the other system, you shouldn't think of that as a change in the reality of the distant system. You should think of it as a change in your knowledge of the distant system. And that's exactly what this sort of interpretation allows you to do for his experiment. So had Einstein known about the Wigner representation, he could have said, you know, for this particular experiment, this is exactly the kind of way that I think it ought to be interpreted. That you measure, you find out some information about one guy, you update your description of the distant guy. And so all that's going on here is not a change in the reality of the distant system, because all along, the distant system is at some point in phase space, the one that's at the intersection of these two guys. It's just that the observer doesn't know it. And the observer is limited, like the prisoners in Plato's cave. They can only find out one or another thing. So they can update their knowledge such that they find the position of this guy, or they can update their knowledge such that they find its momentum, but they can't do both. So this is the kind of interpretation that Einstein would have wanted for the EPR effect. That's what he was arguing. We should think of quantum states as being epistemic. So this remote collapse is just Bayesian conditioning in this approach, as you saw in the homework. Now, if you think about the direct measurements in quantum theory, so I have a system B, I'm, say, measuring its position directly, not by virtue of measuring something that's correlated with it. Then you say, well, OK, what happens? Suppose B starts out in a state where you know the momentum perfectly, and then you measure its position. Well, you might think, all right, after you get the outcome of the position measurement, you now know its position as well. So you knew its momentum, you've learned its position, now you know everything. So you would use a delta function at one point in the phase space. But of course, that would violate this epistemic restriction that we started with. So clearly, that can't happen. And it's not what happens in this theory. Something more interesting happens. And to see that, I'm going to do a model of the measurement, right? So I'm going to think of this measurement as coupling system B with some probe, system A, according to this kind of Hamiltonian, and then measuring the position of the probe. So the way this Hamiltonian works is it's going to look at the position of B, and it's going to generate translations in A proportional to it. So PA is the generator of translations in classical mechanics. So when I evolve something according to this Hamiltonian, it means that A is going to be shifted in position by an amount proportional to the initial position of B. And so if I measure the final position of A, and I knew its initial position, I can figure out what the initial position of B was. So I measure the shift in A, discover the original position of B. Of course, for that to work, it had better be the case that system B is prepared in a state of well-known position. Because if I knew nothing about the position of A to start with, then measuring its position at the end wouldn't teach me how much it's shifted. You know, I need to know where it started. But assuming that this uncertainty principle, this epistemic restriction, applies to all systems, it should also apply to the probe. So if I know where its position is, I can't know anything about its initial momentum. Okay, and now here's the key bit. This coupling, which is Hamiltonian, has a kind of action-reaction principle built into it. When system A measures the position of system B, inevitably B measures the momentum of A. So this Hamiltonian can also be thought of as follows. QB is the generator of boosts in momentum. And this coupling tells me to boost the momentum of B by an amount that depends on the initial momentum of A. But the initial momentum of A is completely unknown. Therefore, B gets boosted by an amount that's completely unknown. So what's going to happen as I couple these two guys together is that my ignorance of this guy's momentum is going to sort of infect my knowledge of this guy. So this guy is, wherever he was, he's going to become boosted in momentum by some totally unknown amount. So I'm going to learn, I'm going to lose my knowledge about the momentum because it gets shifted by an amount that I don't know. So that's the first thing that happens. If all you know is that this coupling has occurred, you suddenly lose your knowledge about momentum. But then you measure the position of this guy. You find some particular result. And that allows you to tell you how much this guy has shifted by, which allows you to know what the initial position of this guy was. So although you know that its momentum at the end has nothing to do with what its initial momentum was, you do know what its position is at the end. So this is your final state of knowledge. And that looks exactly like collapse in quantum theory, right? You're starting with a momentum eigenstate, you measure position, you collapse to a position eigenstate. That's so this model, which starts with the classical theory, adds a restriction on how much you know, can do justice to that feature of quantum mechanics. It can reproduce qualitatively a collapse rule. Okay, so that's the continuous variable case. I hope that it seems somewhat compelling as an explanation for certain features of the quantum form load. Now I want to say a few words about doing the same thing for bits, two-level systems. So the philosophy is the same. I'm going to start with the classical theory of two-level systems. I'm going to add a restriction on how much you know. So I need a bit of formalism for that. I'm going to want a discrete analog of Poisson bracket. So remember what we had in particle mechanics. So I'm doing it for the general case now of n systems. I had a configuration space. I defined a phase space, functionals on the phase space, like these guys. And here's the Poisson bracket for n systems. It's just a sum of the Poisson brackets for each system. Well, you can do the same thing for my discrete theory. Just replace the real field with the integers mod 2. Okay, so everywhere where I had real before, now it's just Z2. So I have a phase space. So each one of these positions now is either just 0 or 1. And so that's the configuration space. The phase space has positions and momenta, but each of these are, again, just 0 or 1. And I have functionals, like these guys. And now I don't have derivatives. It's a discrete theory. But I can define a discrete analog of a derivative. So I take, if I want to know the Poisson bracket between f and g, I just take f of the point m in phase space, this discrete phase space, shifted by 1 along the xi for the position of the ith particle. So I take that minus f of m, and g of a shift along the momentum of the ith particle here. So this is very much like just a discrete analog of the Poisson bracket. These details aren't particularly relevant. I just want to show you precisely how to define this theory. The point is this, that just as in the continuous theory, we said that perfect knowledge corresponded to knowing a set of variables that commute relative to the Poisson bracket. Similarly here, you're going to say an observer can only have knowledge of the values of a set of canonical variables that commute relative to this discrete Poisson bracket I just defined, and maximal ignorance otherwise.
What are x and p's in
So here they're just discrete position and discrete momentum. So I'm thinking of this classical system, which has two levels, as like a position. It's either 0 or 1.
Why don't we do it by a smear?
why don't we do it by spins?
Yeah.
You'll see it's justified again a posteriori. I'm going to show you that this theory gets you a lot of the formalism of qubits, and that's why we're doing it this way. I mean, we could have imagined starting in some, like we did last time, I had like a sphere, which was my underlying hidden variables for a qubit. Here, my underlying hidden variables are just a discrete position and a discrete momentum. And you'll see that you can do justice to a lot of quantum theory in this sort of way. The details actually aren't particularly important. I've just showed you this for completeness, but your intuitions about quantum operators will carry over to this scenario. Let me just tell you how it works. So here's the phase space now. I just have two possible positions and two possible momenta for my system. So it's a phase space that has only four distinct points in it. And if I ask what are the canonical variables, those are going to be linear combinations of position momentum. But again, the coefficients are drawn from the integers mod 2. So there's only three possibilities. I could know, I could talk about the position, the momentum, or the sum modulo 2 of position and momentum for this guy. That's it. If I say, you know, what are the sets of variables that commute relative to the Poisson bracket, the answer is just the singleton sets. No pair of these observables commute relative to the Poisson bracket. And that's just what we would have in quantum mechanics. These guys are analogous to spin X, spin Z, spin Y. No pair of them commute relative to the matrix commutator. So in this model, you say you can know any set of variables that commute. So you can know position, for example. This is what it would look like. So you could have a uniform distribution over these two boxes, where you know that the position is zero and you know nothing about the momentum. And I just draw that uniform distribution as those boxes colored in. If I knew that the position was one rather than zero, then it's just this distribution. So that's like our position eigenstates from before, except in the discrete case. Over here, the momentum is known to be either 0 or 1. Here, x plus p could be 0, so that corresponds to the points where x and p are both 0, or where they're both 1. Here, x plus p is 1. And that's it. These are all the ways of having knowledge of one of these variables. So there's only six states of complete knowledge in this theory. Here they are. And then there's one other state of knowledge, which is just you know nothing. So you have a uniform distribution over all four possibilities. And the analogs, the quantum analogs of all this, is the z spin eigenstates, the x spin eigenstates, and the y spin eigenstates. And this is like the completely mixed state. So here I'm again using the quantum information notation of 0 plus or minus 1, 0 plus or minus I times 1. So I have to convince you that this is a good analogy. I mean, if you look at the overlaps of these sorts of things, they have the same overlaps as the quantum states. But OK, let's start with convex decomposition. So we made a big deal of this in the first week. We pointed out that there's many ways of decomposing the complete mixed state into convex sums of orthogonal quantum states. Well, in this sort of approach, it says the following. Look, each one of these pure quantum states does not describe reality completely. It's also a distribution over underlying hidden variables. And if I say either this is what I know, or this is what I know, but I'm not sure which, right? I assign equal likelihood to this distribution and this distribution. Then I just average those two distributions and I get the totally uniform distribution. And similarly here, if I average these two distributions, I get uniform. And if I average these two, I get uniform. So there's a natural explanation of this multiplicity of decompositions that comes from assigning pure states to distributions that are not complete. Complete knowledge. So in this theory, we have a distinction between mixed and pure states. This guy's mixed, that guy's pure, and we have the multiplicity of decompositions. What does the shape of the space of epistemic states look like? Well, remember, classical theories were described by simplices, right? So if I just said all the ways of knowing which of the four states you have, it would just be this poorly drawn simplex here, a tetrahedron. The epistemic restriction says you can only have these kinds of knowledge, which are, you know, equal probabilistic combinations of these two guys, that's this, equal combinations of these guys, that's this point, and so on. So these seven points inside the simplex are the only ways you can know about the system, according to this theory. And so that is a way of drawing the space of epistemic states. And notice that it looks like a skeleton of the Bloch sphere, right? So the analogy goes over to this picture as well, that the shape of the quantum state space is a sphere, not a simplex. The shape of the state space in this theory is also not a simplex. It's more like the skeleton of an octahedron. And that's where you're going to start getting the quantum effects, because we talked about how it's the shape of the state space that determines what kinds of statistics you can see in a theory. So this theory has a non-classical state space. If you ask what are the reproducible measurements that are allowed in this theory, it's just like the last one. You could measure the position basis. So here I'm just coloring the different outcomes differently. So even one outcome would be... So here what I'm saying is that if the physical state is here or here, then I get the green outcome. If the physical state is here or here, I get the red outcome. It tells me what the position was. Here I'm measuring the momentum. Here I'm measuring x plus p. And those are analogous to the three bases that you have for a qubit. So just to be pedantic, you know, if I prepare this guy, for example, where I know x is equal to 0, and then I measure p, so I'm asking is it on this side or this side, well, then I'll get the red outcome half the time, and I'll get the green outcome half the time, because really this guy's in one of these two boxes, I just don't know which. So in the part of the ensemble where it's here, I'll get the green outcome. In that part of the ensemble where it's here, I'll get the red outcome. So the predictions of quantum mechanics, which say that if I prepare a z-spin eigenstate and then I measure x-spin, I get random results, that prediction is explained here by saying that really there's some well-defined underlying hidden variable that determines the result, but the quantum state only corresponds to a distribution over those guys. Yes?
Just to check something. We did the sum in the basis of 2. I mean, for that on the top corner, the sum of x and p is 0. Yeah.
Let me go back. Are you talking about this, or do you want
yes,
me to get this one here? Yeah.
The square on the top right.
Yes.
Is it 0?
Yeah, so x, the addition here is modulo 2. So 1 plus 1 modulo 2 is 0. So both of these squares correspond to x plus p being equal to 0. So it might be clear if I always wrote mod 2 whenever I use plus on these slides. But yeah, because we're in the integers mod 2 here, I just sort of said addition is always going to be mod 2 wherever we see it here. So okay, we have a simple explanation of these kinds of measurements. And then we just play the same trick. So what are the transformations that are allowed according to this postulate about the restriction on knowledge? And it turns out there's a discrete analog of canonical transformations. They're basically the ones that preserve this discrete Poisson bracket I defined for you. And if you work it out, you find that all the permutations of these four ontic states are allowed. Right? So any permutation you can imagine, and there are 24 permutations of four elements, so every one of those 24 different permutations is an allowed transformation in this theory. It could be a phase-based displacement, it could be a rotation. I've drawn a few of them here. And now here's the interesting thing. If you ask, how do the epistemic states in their state space transform as I transform the ontic states? So take this guy, for example. This is a three cycle. How should my knowledge transform if the physical state transforms this way? Well, you just apply it, right? So if this is your knowledge here, well, then this ontic state, according to this transformation, moves to the bottom right here. And this ontic state, according to this transformation, stays the same. And so that is wrong. How did I do this? Let's see. So it should have been the one that's here. Let me use a different example. Here's one that I know I got right. I'm sorry I got this wrong. I mean, this guy should be, I should have drawn it with the arrows kind of going from here to here. And from here, I guess it should go to, well, where does this go? So this guy will stay put, and this guy will map to here, so he'll be mapped to this one. So I really should have had a little triangle going this way, okay? And I would have, if I'd done this one, I would find a triangle going this way, and it looks like a rotation, okay? So this was like the Bloch sphere. This transformation looks like a rotation on this skeleton of the Bloch sphere. So it looks like it's simulating a unitary. And if we look at other kinds of transformations, like this guy, he takes this probability distribution to this one. he takes this probability distribution to this one, and these guys remain the same. And that corresponds to a rotation by 180 degrees about this axis. Right? That would take this one down to here and this one over to here. So again, it looks like a rotation in the Bloch sphere, which is what we know that unitaries look like in quantum mechanics. There's a couple of examples that aren't quite like that. If I look at a two-cycle, then this is the kind of transformation it generates. And this is not a rotation, it's a reflection. And reflections on the Bloch sphere correspond to anti-unitary transformations. They're not allowed in quantum theory. So that's a disanalogy. And similarly with the four cycles, they also correspond to what look like anti-unitary transformations. There are these are all the transformations you can do. And what you find is that there's a one-to-one map between the quantum unitaries and these guys. Right? So for every one of these guys, there is some unitary that preserves the Pauli operators that corresponds to it. So as I said early on, this is not precisely quantum theory, but it's very close to it. So there's a map, there's a transformation in this theory for every one of the unitaries that keep you within the eigenstates of Paulis. And they're just the symmetries of the tetrahedron. Okay, so let me tell you a bit about coherence of position. I'm going to stop soon. The problem here is that we're talking about a theory where there's no vector space, right? We didn't start with Hilbert space. Notice that. We started with the classical theory. It was a discrete theory, but it was a classical theory. We added a restriction on how much we can know. There was never any vector space. So the notion of coherent superposition in quantum mechanics is usually defined by talking about linear combination in the vector space. So how are we going to talk about coherent superposition in this model? Well, we can use this sort of trick. So this is another way of talking about coherent superposition in quantum theory. So if you find a unitary, so suppose we're interested in superpositions of states 0 and 1. Find a unitary that maps 0 to 1. Now find another unitary, u prime, which squares to that unitary. If I act u prime on 0, I'll get a superposition of 0 and 1. So let's see how that looks in the Bloch sphere. If I want a unitary that takes 0 to 1, I could rotate by pi around the y-axis, for example. And then if I find a square root of that guy, so rotation by y by an angle minus pi by 2, and I apply that to 0, it's going to take me down halfway to plus. So plus is a coherent superposition of 0 and 1. So if I want, I can think about coherent superpositions in this sort of way, as sort of going halfway from one state to its orthogonal partner and stopping. Another square root of this rotation is to rotate by positive pi by 2 about y, and so that would take me down to the minus state, which is also a coherent superposition of 0 and 1. And as another example, if I rotate around x instead of rotating around y, and I go halfway, I can get to the plus I and the minus I states. So that's one way of defining coherent superposition, and this does admit of an analog. So again, I just say the analog of 0 and 1 are now these distributions. The analog of a unitary is one of these permutations of the ontic states in the theory. So now I want to find a new permutation, p prime, which squares to that permutation, and act it on my state. So for example, here's a permutation that takes this guy to that guy. It takes the top two down to bottom two. And these four cycles are square roots of that, right? If I act this twice, then he will go over and go down, so I'll map to here, and so on. So these both, when squared as permutations, go to that guy. Now if I act this on my original state, I get, yes, I did. If I act this on this state, I should get this distribution. If I act this on this state, I should get that one. So these two should be swapped. So I can think of this distribution as a coherent superposition of these two guys. And it's sort of a similar picture, that this guy gets mapped down to here under this, but the square root takes me halfway. And I can find another permutation that takes me from one to the other, take its square roots, and I get the other two guys. So I can think of coherent superposition in this theory in much the same way as this one. And what's nice here is that it gives you a way of talking about coherent superposition within the hidden variable approach. So for a long time, people puzzled about whether coherent superposition of two quantum states should be thought of as an and, or an or maybe a convex combination. So people often said that we can't interpret the quantum state as a probability distribution, because the only thing that coherent superposition could possibly be would just be a convex combination of the two probability distributions. But then we wouldn't be able to see interference. Here, the idea is that a coherent superposition of these two guys is not a convex combination. That would get me here. It's a new probability distribution that interpolates between these two guys in these interesting ways. It sort of goes halfway from here to here through a permutation. And so that's kind of a more refined way of combining two states of knowledge. And it's the way in these models that coherent superposition is explained. So I think I'm not going to move on to this other stuff. I was going to tell you about how to model multiple systems within the sort of approach, like pairs of qubits. It's a little bit hard to draw because it's a 4D phase space, but it's discrete. But in this approach, you do have product states. So this is like this quantum state. You have things that are like entangled states, which look like this distribution. And you have measurements over the two systems. So I'm not going to go over all this. You have product measurements, entangled measurements. And you get this beautiful set of about 50,000 different transformations which are allowed that map on precisely to certain unitaries over two qubits. And you can do it for three qubits and on. And the way you understand steering and collapse are exactly as I showed you in the continuous variable case. You know, you're doing Bayesian updating, and when you do a direct measurement, if you measure position, you disturb discrete momentum. So the point is that this theory I just showed you doesn't reproduce any subset of quantum theory precisely, but it reproduces qualitatively a lot of the phenomena we see, like EPR steering and the existence of coherent superposition, the fact that coherent superposition is not the same as convex combination. And all along the way, the key aspect of these models that allows you to get these sorts of interpretations is the fact that the quantum state is itself represented by a distribution over some underlying variables. So let me end there, and next time we'll talk about Bell's theorem. You'll probably see a little bit more of this in the next tutorial. Questions, maybe? I know we've gone over time, but let me stop there. If you have any questions, just come ask me. Sorry.